Support for WPR comes from Focus on Energy, a statewide program partnering with utilities to bring energy efficiency and renewable energy solutions to Wisconsin businesses. Details at focusonenergy.com.
Great to have you with us on Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, and we're starting the show today by talking about getting into running as a form of exercise for your mind and for your body. And Martinus Evans is with us today. He's finished more than 8 marathons after his doctor told him to lose weight or die in 2012. He's also coached hundreds of runners. He founded the Slow AF Run Club, a community of over 20,000 members worldwide, and he's the author of the book Slow AF Run Club, the ultimate guide for anybody who wants to run. So as we talk with him, I hope you'll join in. Maybe you're part of a run club, or maybe you're too intimidated to try a race, or maybe even to start running. I think Martinus has some help for you there. You can join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Martinus Evans, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Larry, thank you for having me.
So you're the founder of Slow AF Run Club. And I went online to look at it, at your online presence, and I was impressed. Tell us more about the goals of your run club.
So the goal of this run club is to inspire 1 million people to start running in the body that they have right now. I personally have this huge story of, you know, the doctor calling me fat, and that has translated into me running 8 marathons and hundreds of other different races. And one of the things I just learned is that there's a lot of intimidation when it comes to the sport of running, and a lot of other barriers that I want to be able to level lower so that other people are able to start running into the sport that I truly love.
And so that's kind of a goal of the Slow AF Run Club.
Absolutely.
Well, I'm sure many people have the idea in their mind of what a runner is supposed to look like. Why is it important for you to challenge that?
I think it's a very important job to challenge this, because when you think about most like races out there, like think about your most favorite marathon, whether it's New York City or Boston, most people think marathon runners are the people who are in the front, the elite athletes who have been training their whole life to do that. But once you get past the elite athletes, people who are running these marathons comes in so many various body shapes and shades, and I just want other people to understand that running is for them and they can do it. It may look different from what an elite athlete does, and that's okay, because you're not an elite athlete. You're about getting out there and overcoming your own odds.
So how did you get started? Did you just say, okay, I'm going to start running?
No. I wish it was that simple, right? So as you stated in the intro, back in 2012, I was working in this commission sales job. I was on my feet 8 to 10 hours a day. I went to go see a doctor because I developed some hip pain. Instead of this doctor telling me what was wrong with my hip pain, he told me to lose weight or die. So as we're sitting in this doctor's office, and you know, we're exchanging words and four-letter words that I probably can't say on NPR. I remember telling this doctor, I'm going to run a marathon, and he laughed at me. It wasn't no ha ha ha. Like, he gave me the biggest laugh that you would think your favorite comedian was telling a joke. And he told me if I ran a marathon, I would die on that course. So with all of that being said and all of the anger that happened in that appointment, I stormed out the doctor's office and I bought running shoes that day. And I was on a journey to prove that doctor wrong. And it's something I've been doing for the past, you know, 11, 12 years. Me running 8 marathons and participating in a lot of other races shows that a man of my size and a man of my stature can actually run a marathon and not die.
Yeah, you're a pretty big guy. Just like, I'm a fairly big guy myself. And I run, I don't know if I run the same speed as you, but it's fairly slow, but I can still do it.
Exactly. And I think that's the biggest thing, Larry, is that running is, I would say, an allegory for life. Like, you have to overcome so many obstacles while running that you can take that into other life's issues and be able to overcome that. And that's really the goal of the Slow F Run Club. And my message is to let people know that you can overcome life's marathons.
Well, I have not run a marathon. I've done practically everything up to a marathon, but it's always kind of, I remember the first one, even the 5 and 10Ks, it's intimidating to get out there. You know, you look around at everybody else's, they look like they're all professional athletes.
Larry, can I tell you about my first 5K? So my first 5K, I lined up way in the back. I'm talking about so far in the back that I lined up between a mom with a double stroller and a golden retriever attached to it. Like, that's how much confidence that I had in myself when I first started running. And then when the gun went off and I started to pass the moms and started to pass some of the walkers and then eventually started to pass like other people who was running, that's when it hit me that, oh, snap, I'm actually a runner and I can do this too and I belong here.
Well, that's great. I can remember one 10K where it was a very rugged course through the woods, and I twisted my knee about halfway through, and I think there was one person who finished after me. Mm. And by that time, I finished. But it took about a year for my knee to get better again. But by that time, everybody was over. I had long since gone to have beer or whatever, or soft drinks or food. And it was like, oh, he's finally here. You know, the people that had to be at the site. It was a bit discouraging.
It was a bit discouraging, but one of the things I try to do is flip it on its head to say, what type of determination and grit and mental fortitude did it take you to finish that race and not quit? Even though you were the second to last person, like, you finished that race. And I think for a lot of people, we need to celebrate that. I understand, like, celebrating the people who come in first, second, and third place because they get money for that.
Yeah.
But after that, everybody else is there for their own joy, their own reasons, and their own grit. So for you to be out there and still finish that race, be it you the second to last person, I think that's something to be celebrated, and I think that's something to applaud for. And I think those are the things that I really are trying to change in the sport of running.
What do you remember from your first marathon?
I remember a few things, right? I remember thinking to myself, I don't know how I'm going to finish this race only running. My longest run to that date was maybe 20 miles. So I was thinking to myself, I don't know how I'm going to finish the last 6 miles. That was the first thing I remember. I remember faintly this lady giving me a handful of Jolly Ranchers and telling me thank you for running the race. And I remember telling her, you know, thank you for giving me these Jolly Ranchers because I thought I was going to quit. And the last thing I remember about my first marathon is how proud my wife and my mother was proud of me, because nobody in my family knew how long a marathon was. So when I told them it was 26.2 miles, my mother, being an older woman, was like, "Ooh, I might need to be out on the course. I might need to follow you in the car. What happens if you pass out?"
Well, how long did you train before you ran? I mean, how many other races, and how did you train to get up to that?
So that was an initial journey that took me about 18 months, right? So from the doctor's appointment to me running my first marathon took about 18 months. And it really started off with me training for my first 5K. And then I ran that. And then I ran a bunch of other 5Ks. And then from there, moved up to 10K, ran a few 10Ks, moved from 10K to half marathon. I trained for a few half marathons. And then I was like, you know what? I think I'm ready. And then from that point on, just continue that momentum from half marathon to training for a full marathon.
Yeah. Did you, I think you said in your writings that you got some sort of negative negative comments from time to time in some of those races that were less than complimentary, let's put it that way.
So I get what you're trying to lay down, Larry. So yes, the most simple answer is yes. People, I don't know what it is about people teasing people on the course or like trying to do your best, right? Yeah. That's pretty much what's going on. Like, I've trained how many ever weeks for this thing, and then somebody has the nerve to tell you to lose weight or get faster, and it's like, I'm doing the best thing I can do. So even the name of my run club, the Slow AF Run Club, comes from somebody heckling me, right? He called me, like I said, words that I can't say on NPR, but, you know, he called me slow as blank, right? Mm-hmm. And he told me to go home, and he told me that I didn't deserve to be on out on this course, even though he was the one that was on the sideline drinking a beer, and I was the one who was actually running in the race.
Oh, and how did that just get started? How did that run club get started?
So it started right before the pandemic. I moved around a lot, and I remember moving to the San Francisco Bay Area from the Boston area, and not necessarily having any friends in the Bay Area to run with. So from that point, I was like, well, I have all of these internet friends. Like, how can we wrangle these people together in order to, like, start this group? So from there, it started off with about 40 people who were, like, running and training for marathons, and we were trying to figure out which races we were going to run. And then the pandemic happened. And for most people, like, that was the worst period of time to happen for them. But I think for the Slow AF Run Club, that was the best time, because we were growing like nobody's business, because people wanted to run. They liked the name. And then we started to host virtual races where, you know, you can run anywhere and we'll send you an amazing medal if you ran that race. So we went from like 40 people to like 4,000 people in the first month of the pandemic, and we just continued to grow from there.
Yeah, that's amazing. I remember I didn't get a medal for finishing that 10K that I mentioned earlier. I think they must have been out of medals by the time I, you know, got participation medals or whatever by the time I got there.
You know, that happens. There are some races that I'm still waiting on a medal as well. There's also races that sent me a medal like 4 months after I finished the race. And I was like, what is this? Like, what? What is this?
Martinez Evans, our guest today. He is the founder of Slow AF Run Club. He's completed more than 100 races, including 8 marathons. And he's done it with determination and a bit of humor, too. I can tell that for sure. You have a question for him, or maybe an experience to share. I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234, or you can email us, email address ideas@wpr.org. Clara Neipert's our producer today. Jeff Robbins is our technical director. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR. Thanks so much for joining us today on WPR. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Martinez Evans, and he's here to tell you why running can be for you no matter your body or your experience. It's great to have him with us today. He's founder of Slow AF Run Club. And you can join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Let's turn to Louise in Dodgeville. Louise, hi. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, I have a question for your guest about how to prevent injuries, like as a starting running, you know, as in a non-traditional, you know, elite athlete body. Like, how did you not injure yourself as you started running?
Yeah, as a larger person.
Absolutely, Louise. The best thing that I can tell the people that I coach is that most people who get injured fall for the terrible twos. They do something too much, too soon, or too fast. So the first thing I would tell people is that curb your enthusiasm when it comes to running. I know for most people, they want to get out and run as fast and as long as possible. And that's not necessarily the case for long distance running. You basically want to start out as slow as possible with the shortest distance possible. So one of the things I tell people who are just starting out running is to run for 15 seconds and then walk for 90 seconds and then see how that works for you. And then if you feel like you can run a little bit more, try 30 seconds. If you feel like you can run a walk a little bit less, try 60 seconds of walking, right? Start there. This next thing is that a lot of people get this misconception that you have to, like, the only thing you can do with running is just run. And that's far from the point, right? A lot of us live and work on our butts, for lack of a better word. A lot of us work sitting down a lot. So what happens is we have a lot of imbalances when it comes to our muscles and our lower leg. Since we sit down on our butts a lot, there's a syndrome called dead butt syndrome that happens when you're not firing, when your glutes are not firing enough. So for a lot of people, it's really strengthening your glutes, your calves, and what they call in a scientific term, your posterior chain muscles. Because if you strengthen those are the muscles that, A, make you become a better runner, but also help prevent some of those overuse injuries.
So start slow, and I like that idea of timing, like maybe run for 15 seconds and then walk for, what'd you say, 30 seconds or 60 seconds. I think that's a great idea as well. Louise, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Joy in West Bend will go to you. Hi, Joy.
Hi. Yeah, I second the emotion about don't get macho when you're trying to run. The whole point for me has been just to have good training for myself. I started running when I was about 25, and I'd run a few days, and then I'd, you know, fall off the wagon and start over. So then when I had a boyfriend who encouraged me to get into races, it was not for the point of winning the race. I'm a short person. I was a little overweight, but I just wanted to finish the race. So I got into 5Ks and then 10Ks. I would say for people who want to take up running for losing weight, it does happen. It does happen, and it takes a while. I figure that it took me about 6 months to get used to running on a regular basis and then liking it, and it controlled my appetite after that. I could feel like I was hungry at first when I first started running. After a race, I'd be hungry, but after a while, after 6 months or a year, then it really helped me control my appetite. So after I moved to Milwaukee from California, where all this fitness stuff was all the rage, I found it was a little harder to keep running in the winter. And my work schedule was such that I needed to decrease the amount of time I spent running. I would get up and run before going to work. So I decreased it from an hour, 60 minutes, to about 20 minutes. You know, they said that was all that's really, really necessary for an aerobic workout. So an interesting thing that happened was then I was able to lose more weight when I kind of changed the metabolism in my body, I guess.
Interesting. Well, Martinez, comment on Joy's comments.
So, yeah, I think there's a few things there. One of the things I tell people is that if weight loss is your thing, training for a marathon is probably the worst possible thing that you can do. And I say that is because physiologically, there's a lot of once you go into long distance running, you're not burning fat. You're burning carbs, right? And you're burning carbs that are stored into your liver. So if people are trying to lose weight, you know, sticking to those shorter distance of short bursts between 25 to 30 minutes will probably be the best way for them. But the other thing I try to tell people is that, you know, the numbers on the scale don't matter as much as you think it does. I know we are stuck on like that number on the scale, but the main goal for people is physical activity, right? Being active has so many benefits in your life, regardless if you lose weight. I'm talking about mental health benefits. I'm talking about cardiovascular. There's so many other benefits that comes from regular physical activity that I think sometimes people miss the point of, oh, you're exercising, how much weight you lost.
Yeah.
And it's way much bigger than how much weight you lost.
Yeah. Joy, I get up about 5:30 every morning to do my my run, walk, whatever, through the neighborhood for a few miles. And that's because I'm a morning person. I like it doing that in the morning. And that's a good way to get started. And I agree 100% with Martinez. Probably hasn't helped me lose much weight, but a little bit, maybe. But it's kept it probably from getting any heavier than I am, for sure. And weight, you're right about the weight. It's more the journey and just being out there and being active, Martinez.
Absolutely. I think for me, the person that I am now comes from the fact that I have trained for these marathons and I'm ran these races, because I've learned so much throughout that journey of the person who I am and who I want to be, and how to even transform some of those obstacles and struggles of that I was having in running, and how to translate that to other parts of life.
Yeah, absolutely. Joy, thank you so much for sharing that. Let's go to Judy in De Pere. Hi, Judy.
Hello, how are you today?
Great, appreciate your call. What's on your mind?
Sure, so first of all, your guest's running club sounds totally like my kind of running club, because that is totally what I am. I am slow. I'm not really a runner, I'm more of a walker. But one thing I have accomplished is a Ragnar. I'm not sure if you're familiar, okay, but I got to do a trail Ragnar a couple years ago.
Those are fun.
And I have to be the first to say that I have this little Ragnar sticker on my car, and every once in a while somebody will look at me and say, "Did you run a Ragnar?" And I push my chest out a little bit and say, "Yes, I did." So it was just a great accomplishment.
So what's a Ragnar, Martinez?
So a Ragnar is like a relay race. Sometimes it can be a couple hundred miles, and people hop in vans, and it's usually like teams at 8 or 10, and it's a party. It's literally a party on wheels, because typically there's two vans. You got people in the van. There's some people running at night. You're cheering people on. Some people even decorate their van. So it becomes like this thing, right? This party. When it's all said and done, it's this experience that you'll never forget. It's one of those life-changing experiences that I talk about with when it comes to running.
Oh, man. Judy, that's a great story. Thank you so much for calling. Larry in Eau Claire, your turn. Hi, Larry.
Hey, Larry, how you doing?
Great. Appreciate the call.
Yeah. So you can hear I have a little accent. I'm from originally from Kenya, but I've learned a lot. And I won a Fox Cities Marathon in Aberton in 2023. My question to the guest, so can you speak a little bit about mental toughness when when you hit the wall, like if you're running a long distance, a marathon, you hit 20 miles or 10 miles or 5K for those people who run 5K. How can you speak a little bit how you can help those people who want to run the 5K, 10K, or 20 miles?
Yeah.
And you hit the wall. What do you need? You know, that's also the mental toughness of any long distance is really key.
Well, Larry, thank you. And congratulations for winning that marathon in Appleton. That's a great achievement. But what about this? His questions relating to getting through it, the mental toughness, and so forth.
And I think that's one of the things that that I've just been talking about since I started this journey is how how much life running can be life-changing to you. So yes, in each race, especially in the marathon distance, there's this mythical wall that everyone talks about, and this pretty much happens around mile 20. So you have about 6 more miles to go. And typically that's where most people start to break down and be like, their body start to break down. And from that point, it's all mental and heart. So when you're training for marathons or when you're training for races, these are things that you have to like mentally prepare for. And like, how does that come out for me? It comes out in various different things. Affirmations, right? So I'm chanting to myself, telling myself to keep going one step at a time. It's mindfulness, right? I think for a lot of people, we get out of, woo, that's 26.2 miles. Like, I'll never be able to do that. And for most people, what we're trying to get people to understand is that you're not worried about the distance you got to run. What you're worried about is that mile that you win, that next step that you win, that next breath that you're taking in order to continue to move forward. So those are things that I personally use when overcoming the wall.
Yeah, a lot runs through your mind, doesn't it, when you're in a situation like that?
Oh, man. I'm talking about, Larry, from what I'm going to eat for dinner to did I leave the pilot light on the stove and everything in between.
I know that feeling. Larry, thank you so much again for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Numbers 800-642-1234 or email to WPR. Well, I know you've been a spokesman or are a spokesman for Adidas, but we should talk about shoes. You said the first thing you did was go out and buy a pair of running shoes. And what you need a good pair of shoes. Some can get pretty expensive. What do you want to recommend to someone who wants to try out running?
So one of the things I recommend to people who don't have any experience in running is find your local running specialty shoe store. So these people have a treasure trove of knowledge when it comes to running shoes, how things fit, how things wear down, especially some of these running shoe stores. Like some of the times the brands are even there so that way you can try out the shoes and things of that sort. So that would be the first thing that I recommend, getting people a good pair of running shoes. You don't have to spend $300 or $400. You know, $100 pair or $50 pair of running shoes, I would say get the best pair of running shoes that you can afford and start there. Like, don't get any of the beaters. Don't get any of the shoes that you've been having around for the past 15 years, because that's how, for most people, that's how you get injured, because you got these worn down shoes and then you start to do a new physical activity and now you're in injury time.
Yeah, I've used Brooks Phantoms. Those are what I use, and I had a foot doctor on one time talking about running and shoes, and we agreed that about 500 miles was about it for a pair of shoes, and you know, you're running along with them, and I got 500. I could still go more. But then if you go buy a new pair, you say, oh, my goodness, this makes a difference.
Life is so much different once you get a new pair of shoes after 500 miles.
Go ahead.
I would say for me, for being a larger individual, sometimes I can't even get 500 miles out of a pair of shoes. They start to break down for me around 200 to 300 miles.
Yeah.
And then from there, those become my grocery store shoes.
Okay. Let's talk clothing for a minute. Fabrics, materials that are best for running.
Absolutely, Larry. Let me tell you about this monster that I incurred when I first started running. It's called the Chafe Monster. And
the Chafe Monster. Okay.
The Chafe Monster. And this monster comes when you least expect it. You're out there running. And when I first started running, I ran in cotton everything, t-shirts, shorts, socks, underwear. And I remember thinking to myself, the best thing I need for myself is a nice long shower. And it felt like I was being cut by 1,000 razor blades. So when it comes to somebody who's starting to run, you know, you definitely want to look for fabrics. I would say typically avoid cotton. especially when it comes to those high wear areas, especially if you're wearing like underwear. Like one of the things I try to tell people is spandex is probably the best thing you can do, or compression wear or compression shorts when it comes to your legs or your top. If you, you know, if you're jiggling, it's jiggling, if you know what I mean, right? you definitely want to need some type of compression, some type of spandex, so that way you can kind of keep the moving parts from not moving, right? So that's the best thing. And then, I would say polyester, some poly blends, but typically stay away from that cotton unless you want to visit from the Chafe Monster.
And what about, let's talk about stretching. That kind of reminds me of stretching a bit. It's a way to loosen up your muscles, but what muscles should we make sure to stretch out?
The muscle in between your ears. So, but what I mean by that is that we have to leave that ego at the door. We have to leave some of that, those preconceived notions that we think of running at the door. And that's what I mean by stretching the muscle in between your ears. Of course, you know, you definitely want to do some type of active stretching, some butt kicks, I don't want to go too deep into stretching, but like you can definitely Google and YouTube a good stretching routine, or you can go to our website, slowlyuprunclub.com, and we have a lot of resources there as well.
Yeah, we should recommend it. slowafrunclub.com.
Yes.
I got that right, I think.
Yes.
Describe what you got on there.
So this is actually my merchandise. So one of the things that the Slow AF Run Club has is merchandise that I designed and created and sourced and went to China to find manufacturers and things of that sort. And the reason why I did this is because as a larger individual, when you start getting to sports-specific clothing for running, like they stop at a 1. I don't know what it is when it comes to running gear or sometimes exercise gear. Like they stop at a certain size and they're like, well, nope, no running clothes, no exercise clothes for the larger people, right, Larry? And that is almost like that doesn't make sense when you think about how the world beats down on a person of size. You know, somebody when it comes to the internet bullies or people in your family that's like, you know, you need to lose weight and you need to get active. And then you go to the store and there's nothing to fit you. So it's like an oxymoron. It's like, do the world really want me to get active and be healthy, or do they really just want to point fingers at me? So one of the things that we did with the Slow AF Run Club is that we designed clothes that goes from, in most cases, from an extra small up to a 5X. Because we wanted to be highly inclusive with the individuals who are able to wear our stuff and to let people know that you belong in this sport. Even if nobody else tells you you belong, let me be the person to let you know that you do.
That's really cool. And you've got it. And you, of course, your book goes through, I mean, everything, all the details of running pretty much.
Yeah, man. Like the reason why I wrote this book, Larry, is that most running books out there are written by elite athletes or coaches of elite athletes. So if you think about a regular everyday person who's just trying to get off the couch, I would say 99% of the books out there is going to be useless to them. And they're going to be meant to feel like they can't do this because it's written by elite athletes and coaches of elite athletes. So with my book, it's written from the point of a 300-pound man who's ran 8 marathons and hundreds of other different races to say, come along with me. I'm going to share my journey with you. And I'm going to tell you all the things that I learned the hard way, like how to avoid the Chafe Monster.
By the way, did you ever go back to that? Did you ever go back to that doctor?
Unfortunately not. You know, I actually end up moving, I would say very shortly after me running that marathon, I ended up moving to a different state. So I did not go back to that doctor. And, you know, it's been about over 10 years now. I'm pretty sure he don't think about me and I don't think about him. I'm pretty sure, Larry, I'm just a fat guy that he called fat that day and probably one of many fat people he called fat and told they should die.
Oh, man. It would be fun to send him a note along with a photo of all of your finished marathons, so...
Yeah.
that's me thinking, not you, but it would be something I'd be tempted to do.
I know, right? It would be a dish. So, sir, what they say? Revenge is a dish best served cold.
Patricia in Watertown, your turn. Hi, Patricia.
Thank you for taking my call. I hadn't heard this before, and she said, no, you had not. But there's a Pavlo Normie run in Hurley, Wisconsin, which means way up in northern Wisconsin, 26 miles.
Yep.
Have you done that one, Larry?
I have not done that one. And I bet Martinez hasn't either.
I don't even know where that's at in the world.
Well,
and then come west, or no, pardon me, east to Hurley, 40 miles.
Well,
however, the run is a run between the little town of Upson to Hurley, 26 miles.
Well, that's one of them. Patricia, thanks for calling. That's one of many, many marathon races that occur across Wisconsin, and I don't even know how many there are in the U.S. There's got to be thousands.
Hundreds, thousands. There's a conference that happens every year. It's called, I think, Running USA, where majority of the race directors come together and fellowship. But it'd be so many race directors there, hundreds or even thousands of races or marathons in the U.S. alone.
Well, I tell you what, you've got a great story here, and we didn't get through half of what I had to ask you about eating and everything else. So maybe we can do this again down the road. If you'd be willing to come sit in on a show, we'd love to have you back, Martinez.
Absolutely. I had a ball, man.
I did too. And it's slowafrunclub.com, right?
Yes. slowafrunclub.com.
Okay, thank you again for joining us. Appreciate it very much. Martinez Evans, he's the founder of the Slow AF Run Club. Completed more than 100 races and 8 marathons. He's a big guy, and he's able to do it. And I think you can. I hope you can, too. Love to have him back and do this again. And we're going to switch from running to golfing. And we're going to take a look at Wisconsin's golf courses. You know, a lot of times people think, oh, it's a wealthy person's sport. It is not. I'm living proof. I'm not a wealthy guy, but I've been able to do a lot of golfing in my lifetime. And Rob Jansen, coming up next, executive director of the Wisconsin State Golf Association, and we'll talk about golf courses and what they're up to. And Wisconsin has been voted the top state in the nation for public golf courses. What do you think of that? We'll learn more right after this. I'm Larry Mueller for Wisconsin Public Radio. Got to be one of the great golf movies of all time, Caddyshack. I tell you what, it's a good introduction to our segment coming up right now, because spring is a great time to get out on a golf course. And today we're talking about the public courses in Wisconsin. great to have Rob Jansen with us again. He's the executive director of the Wisconsin State Golf Association. Rob's going to tell us about affordable golf courses worth visiting right here in the state. Plus, we'll cover the big national championships coming to our state and talk a bit about what's going on in the Wisconsin State Golf Association. So I hope you'll join in. What are the courses that you like to visit, the public courses in our state? What makes them great places to golf? Let us know which courses are on your bucket list. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. Rob Jansen, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thanks, Larry. Great to be back talking some golf with you today.
Yeah, Golf Digest just recently listed Wisconsin as the top state in the nation for public golf courses, which is an honor, believe me. What makes Wisconsin a quality state for public play?
Yeah, I think with that list specifically, it's focusing more on, I'd say, the high-end public golf courses that are nationally ranked and people are traveling to Wisconsin to get the chance to play and check off their bucket list. I know we'll talk about some more affordable golf options today as well, which also is what makes Wisconsin such a great state for public golf. But we really have it at all ends of the spectrum. We have the best of the best in terms of high-end public golf, and we have great affordable public golf options spread out all throughout the state. So I'll put up our golf against any state in the country any day.
Yeah, I looked at that list. We have 10 courses, including the number 4 public course in the nation, Whistling Straits, but we have 10 in the top 100, which is, that's a lot of courses to make in the top 100. There's a lot of courses.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's kind of a remarkable story that we have 10 of the top 100. That's 10% of the list right here, Larry, in Wisconsin. Obviously not playing golf year-round either, so it makes it a little harder. Or you'd think it would make it harder to attract golf development and people to come and want to build and create these spectacular courses here. But in our case, it hasn't been a detriment at all, and we're fortunate to have some of the greatest public golf anywhere in the country and really anywhere in the world.
Yeah, I played 6 of the 10, so I haven't gotten to all of them. I haven't been up to Sand Valley yet to play those courses, and I haven't played the Bull yet for some reason. I'm not sure why. I just didn't get around to it. But those are absolutely fantastic courses. But I also, last night, Rob, I sat down. I had the list of all of the golf courses, towns in the state or cities in the state with golf courses, and I thought, I'm going to check and see how many of these I've played. So I spent some time going through that whole list, and I'm sure of these. And there may be a couple or three that I just missed, but I have played 56 courses in Wisconsin. And if you put a pin on the map, from the bottom of the state to the top of the state and pretty much all through the state, I've been able to play some wonderful public courses.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good number. I think you've got me beat there. I can't say I've played 56 different courses in the state yet myself. So I've got to get to work here a little bit.
And if I'm not mistaken, that's like right around only 9% or so, or maybe 10% of all the golf courses we have in the state.
Yeah, pretty close to 10. We've got about 500. Courses that includes private courses as well, but in terms of total courses and facilities, the number's right around 500. So yeah, to hit 10% of the list is no small feat there.
Yeah, so I think it's worth mentioning or talking about the Wisconsin State Golf Association itself. You're the executive director. What's its purpose?
Yeah, so we're a 501c6 nonprofit. Our mission's pretty simple: to promote golf in Wisconsin. Pretty broad, and allows us to do that in a variety of different ways. We provide services directly to golf courses. We'll visit courses, measure them, rate them, help educate them on the rules of golf, the rules of the handicap system, to track kind of your golf ability and allow players to compete against others, even if they're at different skill levels. And then we provide services to individual golfers. We provide those official USGA handicap indexes to golfers. We provide golf competitive tournaments for players of all skill levels all across the state at great golf courses in all parts of Wisconsin, which is a lot of fun. We publish a golf directory, a nice print piece that lists all the great courses in our state and where you can find them, a little bit of information about them. So if it's promoting golf in Wisconsin, I'd say we're probably doing it, or, you know, want to start doing it.
And if I'm not mistaken, you get into things like integrated pest management and maybe community engagement.
Yeah, we work closely with the Golf Course Superintendents Association. That's more their wheelhouse when it comes to creating best management practices for, for running and managing the courses and the agronomy side of things. We do a lot with junior golf and youth development, and we're looking to get more involved in adaptive golf here in the not too distant future for golfers with various disabilities or limb loss, things like that. We want to make sure that all are welcome to play this great game.
Yeah, it is a great game to play. I pretty much walk most of the time. Unless I have to ride, your 18 holes is a pretty good 6 mile walk.
Yeah, it's a great walk. I know you were just talking a little bit about running, but I'd say golf's one of the best walks out there to get your steps in. Do it in a mostly enjoyable way. Not all shots are fun, I wouldn't say. There's certainly some frustration along the way, but I think that's part of what makes golf great.
Yeah.
Well, it's not that easy. The shots that don't go too well make the shots that go great all that much sweeter. But I'm with you. I love to walk. It's great exercise. Great to be outside and just take in the sights and sounds. I've even done some different fundraisers for our foundation, specifically our Youth on Course program, which provides $5 rounds of golf for junior golfers at participating courses all throughout the state. So to raise some awareness and funds for that program, I walked and played 100 holes of golf in a single day. So that's a lot of golf. That's a lot of steps, a lot of walking, maybe a little bit of running mixed in there too. But it's always fun to push myself and try to do stuff like that occasionally too.
Yeah, I did 72 holes 2 days in a row, which is that was a long time ago.
Yeah, wow. What was that for?
That was for the fun of it with a good friend of mine, Don Rathman.
Okay.
And we had the opportunity to do it, so we did it 150 holes and or 144 holes and whatever it was in 2 days. And I couldn't do that. I don't think I'd be able to do that without a cart, for sure. This day and stage of my life anyway.
Yep.
Samantha called, couldn't stay with us. She wants to recommend golf courses in Ettrick, Whitehall, and Arcadia.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's, I was putting a little thought into some great affordable options throughout the state, and honestly, it's hard to find golf courses throughout the state that aren't affordable. So depending on what part of the state you live in, chances are, if you just look at the courses within 10, 15 minutes of where you live, they're all going to be pretty great, affordable options, for you to go check out and support.
Yeah, I was just thinking about that. This last week, I played a course on Friday afternoon, later in the afternoon, just 9 holes at Monona. And that was $16. I think, to play. And then I played 18 holes, walked 18 holes on Sunday afternoon, and it was $32 or $3, something like that.
Yep. Yeah, no, I mean, those are great values there, and I think you get a pretty good bang for your buck. If you're playing nine holes, I'd say that's two pretty good hours of entertainment, and playing 18 holes, you get double the fun there. Have you been able to check out the Glen Golf Park that was recently renovated and updated?
I have, and it is a wonderful, wonderful course. It's just a it's such a nice, they did such a wonderful job with it. And I assume you've had a chance to play it.
I haven't. Yeah, I've seen it, but was not a day I was able to play it. So definitely have to get back to the Madison area to play that one myself.
Yeah, and we've got. We got Marty in Madison. Marty, hold on. We're going to take a quick look at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back with Marty and with Rob Jansen and with your calls. Give us a jingle. The number is 800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. And we'll be back right after this quick look at the news. Stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you with us on Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here as we talk golf and golf courses in Wisconsin with our guest, Rob Jansen. Rob's the executive director of the Wisconsin State Golf Association. So where do you golf? Maybe to get the best value or to have the best time? What courses are best this time of the year? Tell us why you love golf. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And let's, Marty's been waiting from in Madison. Let's go right to Marty. Thank you for calling, Marty, and thanks for waiting.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. There's two courses that, for me, it's the putting. And one of the courses is affordable. It's Evergreen Golf Course in Elkhorn. It's 3-9 holes, but it's whoever does the greens is a genius. No matter, I have never been on this course where the greens weren't immaculate and rolled true. Friday nights, they've got a live band out back. If it's 50, 60 degrees on a day in December, they're one of the only courses I've found that is open as long as there's no snow on the ground. And the other one is on the other end of the economic scale, but Lac La Belle. I've never seen any greens on any course like this place. You've got to be a mathematician and a genius to figure out speed and slope. And it's just crazy great.
Marty, thanks for calling. So we got the Elkhorn and Lac La Belle. Rob, what do you think?
Yeah, no, I haven't been to Evergreen myself, but I have been to Lac La Belle last year. The course was bought by new ownership a few years ago, and they did some unbelievable renovations to the club. And yeah, definitely a great course to check out. Some really fun, interesting green complexes, like Marty mentioned. Some holes and greens you'll look at and be like, wow, how did they even do that? And get to watch your golf ball do some pretty fun things while you're out there too. But a great clubhouse, a lot of history, one of the oldest golf courses in Wisconsin, and just a fantastic experience, I would say, there.
Well, let's talk about course. What are some of your favorite courses to play in the state?
Yeah, it's so hard to pick. There's so many good ones. It really just depends on you know, what's going on or when I have the chance to play and who I'm playing with. But our offices are in West Allis. There's a great Milwaukee County park system of golf courses, including one we could walk to, Greenfield Park, which is a fun 18-hole course, always in good condition, very playable, very walkable. I don't know, unless you have health issues or need to take a cart, I'd say absolutely walk that course. It's an enjoyable way to check it out. We'll go out there, you know, as a staff occasionally and pop over there. It's so close and such a fun time and a fantastic value as well. It's always fun to check out. I went to Loch LaBelle to check it out post-renovation just to see the changes they'd made and get to experience the new course and design, which was a lot of fun. And we talked about some of the heavy hitters on the Golf Digest list. Those are always a treat to play and certainly some of my favorites, which is with as good as those courses are and, some of the settings and topography of some of those courses is just hard to beat, which is why they get the recognition and rankings that they do. I know you said you haven't been up to Sand Valley yet, but talk about a place that just keeps building some fantastic golf courses and adding more and more golf courses. They're opening another one up this summer, which I'm excited to go check out, called Sedge Valley, which will open for play on July 1st. But I've played the other courses up there, Sand Valley, the original course, Mammoth Dunes. They have a 17-hole par 3 course called the Sandbox, which is just a ton of fun to play. So just too many to name and narrow down the list, but I never have a bad time on the golf course. It really doesn't matter where I'm playing. If it's a beautiful day with good company, I'm going to have a good time.
Yeah, that's my story, too. Jim and Camp Douglas, we'll go to you. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Larry. Yeah, I'm a member at Castle Rock here down by Mauston, Wisconsin. And being a member, we're entitled to about 20 reciprocal courses. And what you end up doing is paying essentially for the cart, and then you get to play the other courses. But one other thing, too, I'm playing with a gentleman who at one time was a upper echelon staff member of the WSGA, Dick Rolig. And I was just wondering if you heard of him, know him, or remember him. And I'll take your comments offline. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling.
I have heard the name. Not somebody I ever had a chance to spend any time with, unfortunately.
He did bring up an interesting point. There are some memberships there. All right, you can become a member of a golf course and, you know, that might bring visions of a lot of money, but there are many courses where you can become a member and then you get the opportunity to play other courses for, that are part of this grouping, I guess, that allow you to play for essentially about half price.
Yeah, I mean, really helps you get more bang for your buck. And I do think a lot of people associate a golf membership with maybe a private facility, which is going to be quite expensive. But most public facilities offer some type of membership or loyalty program, which can help your golf get even more affordable or provide you unlimited access to the course for a relatively low flat fee. And if you plan to play a lot of golf, it's certainly going to be worth your while. If you're not sure about how many rounds you might be able to get in, maybe some other options are going to be a better fit for you, to play when you can and get the best deal that you can at the time.
Somebody else is wondering, how are golf courses in Wisconsin trying to attract people to the sport? Interesting question.
Yeah, it hasn't been too hard these last couple of years. Golf in Wisconsin and across the country really has been booming kind of post-COVID as people gravitated to outdoor and safe recreation activities, and a lot of people that played golf in the past maybe returned to the game and started taking it up a little bit more. Otherwise, I think it's just been the culmination of a lot of great programs that have been in place and junior golf efforts to showcase the game to kids as they're growing up. And I mentioned our Youth on Course program, another way we're attracting more new and younger customers to courses and making sure it's affordable for them to go out and get a chance to play. But, with as good of a spot golf is in nationally and in the state right now, the short answer is courses aren't having to do that much to attract new golfers or any golfers to their course. You're seeing a lot of full tee sheets, and it can be a challenge to get tee times if you're not planning ahead and having some flexibility with your schedule. That's certainly not going to last forever, so I think most courses are taking hopefully a measured approach and still preparing for the future when they might have to do a little bit more and work a little bit harder to attract golfers to their facility.
Yeah. I'm a member, a life member, actually, of the First Tee program. And I don't know if the WSGA does much with that First Tee program. But my daughter, Emily, went through that, I think, starting, she was 8, I think, when she started in that program. And it's very affordable or free opportunity for kids to learn all aspects of golf.
Absolutely. Our office, I mentioned we're in West Dallas. We share office space with a few other golf associations, the Wisconsin PGA, and also the First Tee of Southeast Wisconsin, which is kind of the local chapter for this area. There's other First Tee chapters throughout Wisconsin doing similar things and similar programming to bring kids into the game. But, yeah, great programs if anyone has kids looking to get started in the game or maybe don't know where to start or just looking for a new activity to try. Definitely check out the First Tee in your area. Look at their summer camps and programs that they have. They're not only teaching golf, they're teaching great life skills that these kids are going to carry forward with them, hopefully for the rest of their lives as well. My kids are getting to that age where they're starting to get a little bit more interested in golf, which is fun. So we'll certainly be checking out some programs. And our next door neighbor is doing one of the First Tee programs here locally as well. So good to see a lot of people taking advantage of what's out there.
Yeah. How do you find, John, here's another question. How do you find equipment? You're just getting started sort of for discounted rates.
Good question. I mean, a lot of answers depending on what exactly somebody's, looking for. A lot of the, big box retailers have a used club section where they'll have sets that were traded in from somebody who came in to buy a new set of the latest and greatest technology. So that's always a good place to start. If you're in the Milwaukee area, our First Tee chapter here I mentioned accepts club donations. They kind of get the clubs kind of cleaned up and put sets together and offer those for resale, which is a great, really affordable option for people to get started. Can always check out the internet too, or eBay, for deals and discounts that might be out there if somebody's looking for something more specific or even brand new sets. There's lots of very affordable, nice newer sets that somebody could get for, a pretty reasonable price for some clubs, a bag, and everything you need to at least get started.
Have you got, here's another question from Cora. Could you give a list of, budget courses or courses around the state that may, be for those who are budget-minded?
I would typically recommend to start with the municipal golf courses in the area. Like I mentioned, Milwaukee County Parks have a great system. I know you mentioned playing some of the Madison City courses. And those are typically going to be some of the best well-maintained, affordable courses in your area. I'd also recommend people to check out our website at wsj.org. We have a courses section that offers an interactive map where you can zoom in and look at different parts of the state and click the little pins and icons to learn a little bit more about a golf course or check out their website. Just a few different ways to maybe find some hidden gems out there that might not even require too much travel.
I was thinking about a course outside of Madison, a Riverside Golf Course in Janesville, which to me has got to be one of the hidden treasures of the state, especially, and not only it's a pretty course, but also the rates, it's like $30 to play 18 holes there. And it is really a nice course for the money, for sure.
Yeah, they're a frequent host of some of our WSGA tournaments that we run. They host an annual competition for the best amateurs in the state called the Ray Fisher. And players just love going down there and playing. It's not long by modern standards, so no. You typically are going to see some low scores when the best amateurs in the state get out there to play. But they love it. They love the course, and definitely worth checking out for anyone who gets down to the Janesville area.
Yeah, at my age, length has become an issue, so I enjoy courses like that.
Yep.
as a matter of fact, oh my gosh, I had a chance to see a golf documentary called The Dream Loop that you helped produce, and I really enjoyed watching that. You put together a schedule for a couple of guys, DJ and Stefan, to play Wisconsin's top 10 public courses in just 2 days.
Yeah, actually, we did it in just under 40 hours, which I think is pretty incredible. If there was a Guinness World Record for something like this, this would have to be it. And I don't know how you could beat playing 10 different courses, all ranked in the top 100 in the country, all in the span of 40 hours. And they were playing real golf. I mean, hitting the shots. They're putting out. They pick up occasionally having a bad hole, but it wasn't just, hey, let's go to this course, play a couple holes to say we did it and go to the next. They played every hole at every course. It was just a fun way we thought of to highlight the great golf we have, how close and convenient it is together as you're building out a golf trip. And how we set it up, day one, we've got four courses in Kohler, the two at Whistling Straits, two at Black Wolf Run, plus the Bowl, which is just 10 minutes away. So five really fantastic golf courses that you could drop a blanket over, really, when looking at the map. So that was the first day of the trip. The second day of the trip was a lot more difficult. We started playing Mammoth Dunes in Sand Valley at the Sand Valley Resort. Had to walk both those courses because they're walking only facilities. So definitely was some
running,
some fast
involved.
Walking, some jogging, and a few times where I'd say a full blown sprint down some of the big hills there. Then had to hop in our minivan and drive up to Century World. Got to play pretty fast around there and carts. It was a day the course was closed for maintenance, which made the whole thing possible. And then back in the car and drove to Lasonia, played the Lynx course, and then back in the car, another hour or so drive to Erin Hills to finish 10 courses in under 40 hours, and had to walk Erin Hills. So that's a good walk to finish 10 courses in 2 days right there. But we had a videographer with us for the trip and captured some great footage. We weren't sure what the finished product was going to look like, but it turned into a pretty cool 60-minute documentary that we did in conjunction with No Laying Up, which is a really popular golf media company that's out there. You can view the Dream Loop on their YouTube channel at No Laying Up, or youtube.com/No Laying Up, or just type it into Google to find it pretty easily. But a lot of fun to put together and just kind of share all these great courses and kind of a fun, unique way instead of just showing some golf course shots of all 10, which some people might like, but we thought this would be a little bit more engaging to put together to tell the Wisconsin golf story.
Yeah, they were starting pretty early in the morning.
Very early, yeah. Those were some early wake-up calls. Only got about 3 hours of sleep between the 2 days. That was probably the biggest challenge, just working on very little sleep and a lot of physical activity. And to drive from kind of that colder area across the state over to Sand Valley was, about a two-hour drive kind of in darkness. And I was the driver, so I got no sleep. And I was wide awake. I was in great spirits and all that. But a few of the guys were able to get a few power naps in there before we got close to Sand Valley and got some sleep and got back up and did it again.
Well, I'm looking forward to playing those Sand Valley courses. All the Kohler, the four up there, I've played all those. But Wisconsin, by the way, Bill just emailed. He says, great show today. He just counted over 75 courses that he played in Wisconsin. He likes Nagawaki and Waukesha, in Waukesha is his favorite. Oh, that's a lot of courses. We've got several national championship championships coming. We got the 2025 U.S. Women's Open at Erin Hills. And that's a long course and a challenging course to play, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's hosted the U.S. Open, so it's long enough and hard enough to test the best golfers in the world. This will be a championship to test the best women from around the world on a great golf course. It'll be set up a little differently, a little shorter, but still be a fantastic test for those golfers next year. It's always exciting when the big national championships come to Wisconsin. We've had a great run over the last 10-15 years of some big time championships, the PGA Championship, US Opens, Ryder Cups. It's all been here. So that's another great part about Wisconsin. You can play some really great courses, but they also have great history. You've seen them on TV. You've seen the biggest events in the world played at these courses. And, that next chapter gets written next year at Erin Hills with the U.S. Women's Open, which is exciting.
And we just got a minute left, but a listener wondered about courses. They take up a lot of acreage. Many use pesticides. What do you think about that? And by the way, we'll be talking about that on tomorrow's program a little bit.
Yeah, no, it's certainly a fair question. I'd go back to our relationship with the Golf Course Superintendents Association. They've done some fantastic work and research when it comes to, that specific question. They put together an extensive best practices manual for courses around the state that probably covers every single topic you could think of, to minimize the impact to the environment, make sure that, that land is, is being protected and cared for appropriately and, maintaining it for the enjoyment of, golfers and non-golfers in a lot of cases around the state.
Yeah.
And doing a lot of good. So.
Always a pleasure, Rob. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. Really appreciate it. Rob Jansen,
yep.
Yeah, Rob Jansen, Executive Director of the Wisconsin State Golf Association. And we will be talking about some golf courses, transforming them into sanctuaries that wild animals can enjoy. Stay with us. Lots in store on the WPR Network. I'm Larry Mueller.